Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
I'm going to call the committee to order. We do have a quorum, is that correct?
Yes.
All right. I'm wondering if Representative Morgan, you look like you were just scouring the minutes, and I'm wondering if you would make a motion to adopt the minutes.
Scowling? Scowling.
Scowling. The minutes of February 7th, is that correct, Jamel?
February 7th and February 12th.
And also both sets of minutes, February 7th and February 12th, if you would be so kind.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Morgan, after having scoured the minutes of February 7th, February 12th, moves their adoption. Is there any discussion? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did we include in the minutes the fact that you, yes, you laid over the bill. Thank you. I was just looking for that.
You bet, Representative Erickson. That's very important. Make sure that we're proceeding appropriately. Any other questions? If not, all in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Members, as it so happens, the chair has a bill up, and so I'm going to relinquish the gavel to my colleague, Representative Brainerd. Will I go forward and squeeze in between Bob and Helen there and begin our testimony of the bill?
I can't read all that fast, sorry.
Well, as Representative Mariani moves to the podium for testifying, I'd like to take a moment to pause. We have some special guests with us today, a number of students from Crosswinds Arts and Science School, and we'll be hearing more about Crosswinds a little bit later in the session. But today I want to take a moment to honor those present and to acknowledge some achievement, a special experience that several of the students have had as a National World Savvy Knowledge to Action Plan second place winners. And here's what I know about their project. We could probably learn a lot more interesting things directly from them, but they used water straws and education programs to teach villagers in third world countries about clean water. So I think we might have something to learn. Maybe we should invite them to testify in our environmental committee. So let's welcome and honor our students. Would the students please stand up? Would you please stand up to be acknowledged? All of you. So we're happy to have you with us, and we hope we'll get some chance to maybe visit a little more personally about your achievements. So with that, Representative Mariani, are you set?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay.
I am.
And then may I ask, what is your motion?
Madam Chair, I move that House File 247 be recommended to pass and referred to the K-12 Finance Committee.
So Representative Mariani has moved that House File 247 be passed and referred to the Committee on Education Finance. And with that, Rep, would you like to introduce your bill?
Yes, please. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And if we're ready, we can vote. No. I do want to echo the Chair's comments about our visitors today. I understand it was a little slippery on I-94 coming over, so you prudently took your time, and that's a good sign of maturity that you were patient in getting here. Thank you for being here. I have a soft spot for your school, having been in and out of it, including when it was first being constructed many years ago. Have even spoken at some of your classes. And I have some family members that have attended and currently attend the school. And they tell me it's a good school, so I'm not going to doubt their words. So welcome to you all today. Madam Chair, what I want to do is just sort of set the context. For today, my original intent was to take action on the bill today, but at the same time, I think it's important for the committee to have a good, solid, context laid out and an opportunity to have some discussions, particularly with the task force members who we're going to hear from shortly, who were greatly instrumental in shaping the framework around which this bill is modeled after. Madam Chair, members, I don't think we'll be taking a vote this morning. I originally thought we would have reconvened this evening, and then my staff reminded me that today was some special day. What is that? Oh, yeah, Valentine's Day. And that we would probably wind up commiserating, at a bar somewhere and how we messed up our relationships yet again. So we're not going to convene this evening, but we will lay the bill over if we get to that point for consideration or for a vote and discussion on Tuesday. Madam Chair, the state has expressed a compelling interest in not having our school children separated into distinct schools based on different socioeconomic, demographic, ethnic, or racial background. In fact, that was most recently affirmed by this legislature in 2011 in 124D.855, school segregation prohibited. But that's actually just the most recent statements and actions that this legislature has taken over the years on this issue. And I'm going to back up probably about a couple of hundred years here, members, easily. I don't know if any of you saw the movie Lincoln. I was incredibly inspired. I suspect the Representative Erdahl probably saw it three or four times. I was powerfully inspired by the movie, particularly, obviously, as it touched on issues of slavery and racial separation. Members, it's my contention that the issue of race relations is an integral part of our common American history. Our colonial states legislated these issues. Folks just like us in colonial legislatures wrestled with the issue of race relations. And of course, the context back then was, the dominant context was that of the legal existence of slavery. And so the legislation had a lot to do with affirming or not affirming slavery, but also on keeping people separate and segregated along racial lines. This was at the center of our deliberation, also informing an independent nation, and expressions of it found itself, as you all well know, in our Constitution. Slavery and separation challenged our nation, dominated our legislation, and tragically led to the bloodiest conflict in American history, where literally brother and sister were killing brother and sister at unimaginable proportions. With the end of the war and the passage of the 13th Amendment, our nation took a bold step in modern history in ending slavery. And so only the issue of separation continued for us in terms of shaping legal policy. Reconstruction and the 14th Amendment worked to open up opportunities across racial lines, but that was followed by the Supreme Court's, in my opinion, and history bears it out, erroneous Plessy v. Ferguson ruling, which established the legal doctrine of separate but equal, which legalized segregation and gave rise to what we now know as Jim Crow laws across the nation. As you know, after generations of black, white, brown Americans struggling together, the court reversed itself in 1954 with the Brown v. Board decision, making it illegal to have formal legal segregation as a matter of law. That decision, of course, as you all know, rose from a challenge to segregation as it was being manifested in our public education system. Since then, all states have struggled with how to prevent racial segregation when it came not as a result of legal barriers to integration, but rather as a result of practice, supported by our housing, economic, and other social behaviors and the segregation calls forth and has an impact on our public schools. And so these continue to be a feature of the American and the Minnesota landscape, even as our society has grown more diverse And even as the racial diversity has spread, and I've heard this from many of you from different parts of the state, even as racial diversity has spread to more and more communities, the fastest growth of diversity, as you all know, racial ethnic diversity in the last 10 years has occurred in suburban communities and in greater Minnesota, including small town, rural Minnesota communities. And that's a pattern we've seen all across the nation. After Brown v. Board, efforts to integrate Minnesota schools began in the 1960s when the Minneapolis and St. Paul school districts, which at that point had the highest concentration of communities of color in the state, when those school districts adopted voluntary busing plans to integrate its schools. A lawsuit in 1972 produced a U.S. district court finding that Minneapolis schools were illegally racially segregated. The court ordered Minneapolis to desegregate so that no single school could be more than 35% students of color. In the 1980s, the state legislature, this body, stepped in to help St. Paul, Minneapolis, and Duluth schools, so schools of the in cities of the first class, where you had the high concentrations at that time of almost exclusively at that time in Minnesota of communities of color. The legislature stepped in to help desegregate their schools. This included authorizing a local levy for those school districts to carry out those efforts. In 1987, the state legislature again stepped in and appropriated integration grants to school districts in these cities to supplement the work of the levies. In 1997, the legislature created the current Integration Revenue Program to provide state funds not only to the districts and cities of the first class, but to qualifying districts around the state in recognition of the importance of preventing racial segregation throughout Minnesota. Remember, this is 1997. It sounds recent, but if you think for a minute what Minnesota looked like in 1997 and what it looks like now in 2013, I think we would all agree that we've undergone and are undergoing a huge transformation along many lines, but along the lines of racial ethnic diversity becoming a common feature in Minnesota, not just a feature that's present in a few locales. The Department of Ed was authorized to approve rules specifying eligibility for the integration revenue and laying out program requirements. Under pressure to constantly adapt the integration revenue program to match up with the changing realities, in recent years, the legislature asked the legislative auditor to conduct a review of the revenue program. I believe that was 2005, Madam Chair. And as a result of the auditor's findings, some small changes were begun to be implemented by this legislature, including adding the closing of race-based academic achievement gaps as one of the purposes for the use of the integration revenue funds, and also requiring all participating districts, including the St. Paul, Minneapolis, and Duluth schools, to have their plans and budgets approved by the Department of Education. In 2011, the legislature moved to eliminate the integration rule. So now we have a reversal of what had been transpiring over the last, since the 60s, in terms of the state stepping in to provide assistance and resources to prevent segregation and promote integration. In 2011, our legislature moved to eliminate the integration rule and the integration revenue program. After the summer 2011 state government shutdown, the rule was preserved, and the integration revenue was sunsetted in 2014. So, Madam Chair, the urgency with this bill is that in 2014, the integration revenue will be sunsetted. But a task force was authorized by this body to bring back recommendations by February of 2012 to the legislature on how to repurpose the funds to create and sustain opportunities for students to achieve educational outcomes. The law also called for funding stability for districts between the current integration program and whatever new program would be instituted. The law stated that the funds shall be used for the purposes recommended and forwarded by the task force and approved and appropriated by the legislatures. Members, we're going to hear in a few minutes from two members who served on that task force. I had the privilege and humble honor to also be a task force member. I was one of six that was appointed by a DFL governor and joined by six others who were appointed by Republican leaders of the House and Senate. I admit that facing, you know, I'm just a politician, I count just like everyone else, you know. I admit that when I was looking at arguably a 6-6 task force split in terms of political party appointment, that I had little expectation that we would have arrived at a 10-2, a 10-2 member bipartisan agreement to recommend a new integration revenue program that emphasized promoting racial integration while also advancing academic achievement. The task force completed its work on time and submitted their recommendation to us at the legislature. The Senate chose only to hear one of the two minority reports instead of scheduling a hearing and hearing from the majority report. And our body scheduled a hearing of the majority report, but only after the committee deadline. A vote, nonetheless, was taken at that time, and recommendations were, in my opinion, unfortunately rejected by the House K-12 Finance Committee. Having not met the deadline, however, it was more a ceremonial vote than anything else. With a pending sunset and equipped with recommendations from a task force authorized under law, the legislature, nonetheless, took no action in 2012. It is my sincere hope, members, that the 2013 legislature will correct that inaction and take steps to follow its task force recommendations. And, of course, as any bill, take those recommendations as the core from which we would then shape them according to our interests that we bring to this table representing our constituents across the state. So, members, with that, I'm going to stop, and I'm going to ask Madam Chair, two of our task force members, Robert Erickson and Helen Bassett, to come forward and share their recommendations and wisdom from the task force. And my hope is that members will then have a good conversation with them. We do have a long list of testifiers who I think bring all sorts of additional value added to the table, and I'm looking forward to that conversation, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Mariani. You've set a very compelling context for the discussion, and what I would like to do is mention to both testifiers and members to take notes as the discussion's going on, but try to keep your discussion focused. We have quite a long list of very esteemed testifiers, and I'm hoping that we can get through at least the noted list on the agenda, and there will be opportunity either today or next Tuesday for members of the public on either side of the issue who haven't yet indicated their interest in testifying, but it would be helpful to us if you would let us know your interest in testifying on this bill, either pro or con. So at this point, we'll call to the table Bob Erickson and Helen Bassett, members of the task force, and they will summarize for us the main recommendations of the advisory task force report. Whoever of you will go first, if you would identify yourself for the record, please, and then please present your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Bob Erickson, and the Madam Chair and members of the committee, the House Education Policy Committee. It's a pleasure to be here this morning as a member of the Integration Revenue Replacement Task Force. Before you to give you a succinct overview of the work of the task force. I'm in my second term as a school board member for the Lakeville Area Public Schools, the 10th largest school district in Minnesota with over 10,500 students. I'm on the board of directors of the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. I serve in the legislative committee, and as I've indicated previously, I served on the task force. The AMSD legislative platform, which many of you are, there's a lot of familiar faces here that have attended our legislative meetings, and more recently some of you who serve on the House Education Finance Committee, including your chair. Representative Marquardt also viewed this presentation as recently as last week. Our legislative platform at the AMSD, by the way, AMSD represents 38 school districts and over 50% of the school enrollment in the state of Minnesota. In addition, they represent three metro integration districts. So our board of directors has identified key elements that we believe must be addressed if we're going to reclaim our place as a national leader and meet our goal of preparing every student to succeed in post-secondary program, including the creation and creating an integrated and equitable learning environment. Clearly, research shows that students in integrated settings have a greater chance for success than students in segregated schools and classrooms. To ensure integrated and equitable learning opportunities and to increase achievement for all students, the governor and legislature should follow the recommendations of the Integration Revenue Replacement Task Force. Many of you are aware, and it has surfaced at some of the previous hearings, of the work of the Office of the Legislative Auditor. The Legislative Auditor's Office was somewhat critical of the work that was being accomplished, or not, if you will, in the funding for the Integration Revenue Program. Granted, this goes back 7 years. I want you to be encouraged by the fact that a lot of progress has been made as a result of the legislative audit evaluation of the integration program. There's still more work to be done, and I'll address some of those issues shortly. But just so you know, the legislative auditor at that time found that the state law does not set a clear purpose for the program, and as a result, school districts spend integration revenue on a wide range of activities to achieve measurable results and greater accountability. And greater accountability, we think the program's purpose and expenditures should be more focused. And I believe that this, in part, prompted the legislature to create our task force and call for a careful examination of the program. The work of the task force first was to convene the 12 members, as Representative Mariani referenced, 12 members. I think there was little expectation at the forefront that we would accomplish anything, frankly. I think, in fact, I don't believe anybody believed for a split second that we would come to a consensus and reach an understanding on the recommendations. We, under the leadership of our co-chairs, Scott Thomas and Peter Swanson, we chose to operate independently from the Minnesota Department of Education. What I mean by that is we chose to prepare our own minutes, our own agendas. We set the stage for the 41 presenters that we accommodated from October through February of 2012. I think we're quite pleased with that, and the report that you have in your packet today is something we created, we produced, we provided and presented to the Commissioner of Education on deadline. In fact, we did it a year ago today. So Valentine's Day of 2012, we presented the document to the Commissioner and met our deadline of February 15th. In the interest of time, I think going to the photograph would be quicker. With regard to those who served, there's our co-chairs seated. You see Representative Mariani took a prominent place in the photo. But we had a distinguished group a very distinguished group, including the former superintendent of schools in Minneapolis, my good friend, colleague, Myron Orfield, Reverend Battle, Helen, my compatriot this morning, Helen Bassett. We just had a great group and gave of our time and talent and made some significant contributions. Very quickly, the task force recommendations, and this is the substance of my presentation today, was to create an achievement and integration for Minnesota program. Education doesn't function without an acronym. You know that, so this is another acronym. And its aim, and it was developed by the task force to address concerns with the current integration funding program. One of our key focuses was a recommendation that would ensure accountability and oversight at MDE. You're probably aware, but if not, there's only one full-time employee designated to the oversight of the integration program. And there's 131 budgets submitted annually, and there's one full-time employee, Dr. Parks. We have addressed that issue, and we believe that for accountability, that needs to be addressed with some slight increase in staffing. The clear focus on defined limits of use of revenue with regard to submitting plans, developing measurable goals, and the budgets that limit their use in the following areas. Innovative and integrated learning environments, family engagement, very important. We hear a lot of testimony on family engagement, the significance of it. I was always impressed with the program that Worthington School District has in place regarding family engagement. Students of color, protected class students in Worthington cannot attend and be a part of the integration program without their parents attending a class at night to prepare the family for this experience. Professional development, very important, access to opportunity, and increasing the diversity of our teachers and administrators. And finally, examining the merits of one collaborative metropolitan integration school district, which you probably found referenced in Representative Mariani's bill. Let's talk about the fiscal principles for recommendation. First and foremost, which probably might surprise you, but maybe not, we didn't see the need for any additional revenue from the current program in place that ends and sunsets this year. We want to level the fiscal disparities between demographically similar districts, and my colleague Helen Bassett will address that in more detail with regard to her districts. We want to reduce the disproportionality between tiers starting in fiscal 14. You might be surprised, but maybe not, that the Minneapolis and St. Paul school districts have significant percentage of protected class students, students of color, but were you aware of the high percentages in Brooklyn Center, Burnsville, Osseo, Robbinsdale, Worthington, Wilmer, just to name a few? All of those I just named have protected class and their enrollment of over 40%. Over 40%. With regard to that issue regarding the need for more accountability in the budgeting process and measuring the success of these programs, we offered, as our task force recommended, set aside 0.2% of revenue coming from within the current budgeting process, not being added, coming from within. This would provide MDE some additional support to ensure that the program is accountable and the money is being spent appropriately. Create a fiscal model that's predictable over time and stable in two-year increments. Right now, school districts are all preparing their budgets, and the greatest unknown in the budget process, and as the treasurer of our school district, I can assure you that the greatest unknown for us is the future of integration revenue. And as a result, we're submitting our budget to MDE for this program without any certainty of continued funding. I'm going to go to the last and most important element of this these recommendations. The recommendations
are referenced in Representative Mariani's legislation, the bill, for in Section 2, Subdivision 7, with regard to this item number 5. Again, I reiterate Section 2, Subdivision 7 of his bill. At least 80% of the revenue needs to be spent on students. And that's something that comes with great passion from the task force. I just want to emphasize that. 20% to be spent on professional development and administration. And I think the legislative auditor would be appreciative of the fact that we concluded that no more than 10% of the total monies available, made available to the 131 districts, approximately $100 million, could not exceed 10%. That's critical. And if you read the legislative auditor's report in depth, you would note that that's something that was referenced as needing to be pursued and considered, and that's why we're making that recommendation. Again, I want to reiterate that of the $100 million, and I'm just rounding that off, 70% of that budget comes from the state. Did you know that 30% of all integration and revenue funding comes from a local levy? I want to reemphasize, 70% of the program expenditures come from the state. 30% come from a local levy. So as a school board member, when we hold our public hearing for budget, that's certainly emphasized in our budget. And in our budget, it represents $350,000 of a local levy. So we are a stakeholder. We're not solely dependent on the state. The Star Tribune gave our work a very positive grade and emphasized in the balance of the editorial that it was a bipartisan effort, and I think they were surprised as well. MinnPost identified the work that the task force did. I've just given you the headline indicating that we completed our work on time and we forwarded it to the commissioner. Again, I want to reiterate that the Association of Metropolitan School Districts legislative platform addresses to create an integrated and equitable learning environment. And the details of that are denoted here, requiring a revised desegregation rule, allow school districts to develop plans and partnerships that address the unique needs of their students. And you're probably aware many of the school districts that participate in integration are done through a collaborative partnership. Burnsville and Lakeville, for example, jointly operate that. And finally, something that Bob Erickson, as a task force member, has been very passionate, and you heard about this at your most recent committee meeting. You heard from the Minneapolis Public Schools about AVID, Advancement via Individual Determination, a very successful funded program using revenue from the integration program from the state and the local districts, and it has demonstrated in the 5 years it's been in place definitely closing the achievement gap. Just amazing, the good work of AVID. What's interesting about AVID is that the AVID program, it's a national program, creates a learning environment for example, using, if you haven't heard, Cornell Notes.
Excuse me, Mr. Erickson. Yes. You have a wealth of information, but we have so much to hear today. So I'm hoping you can wrap up yours and give Ms. Bassett a chance, and then we have a few member questions, but I'd like to hold the member questions until we've heard from the task force.
My apologies. So AVID is a proven program, Young Scholars Program, Jobs for America, is just three examples. I'll pass on AVID. I've addressed that. I want you to know that Myron Orfield and I did address the Education Finance Working Group, so we brought our recommendation to that group. And AMSD will testify later about their position paper on funding school integration, providing the revenue for that. Just thank you for this opportunity. Again, I want to reiterate, without a law change, the integration levy goes away after the current school year. And we would encourage you to consider following in the footsteps of our task force, a bipartisan approval. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Erickson. Now, Ms. Bassett, do you have a do you need a program change there? Are you waiting for
a
PowerPoint?
No, I'm fine. I'm just wondering if it's already on here.
Okay.
I think
well,
it is.
Well, I am going to. Representative Ertl has a quick question for Mr. Erickson. So if you wanted, and then Representative Barrett, if you don't mind, I'll hold you until after Ms. Bassett. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I hope it's a quick question, Mr. Erickson. But you said that 80% of the money is spent on students.
Under our recommendation, it would be. It's not currently the policy of the Minnesota Department of Education regarding this program.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Erickson, could you just give me some examples of how money is spent with students, some programs or whatever, just a few examples utilizing this money?
In our district,
Mr. Erickson.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. Representative, in our district, cultural liaisons to connect with families, connecting families and their students with our programs. With regard to the ABET program, a substantial amount of our resources that we receive are spent on that program because of its proven success in closing the achievement gap. Training for all of our teachers to be more sensitive and to relate to students of color and the specific needs that they have, including language barriers that oftentimes accompany those students.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted some examples so we had some concept of how the money's being spent.
Well, thank you, Representative Ertl. And if you want to follow up on that, that'll be fine. We'll have more opportunity. But Ms. Bassett, we'd be happy to hear your experience with the task force and the recommendations.
Thank you, ma'am. And Madam Chairlady, and I do have a PowerPoint that I'm going to get to. I have a couple of comments I'd like to make for prefacing, if that's okay.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, thank you. And so good morning again to you and also to Chair Mariani and two House members. We thank the committee for this opportunity to share comments about the work of our task force and the subject of integration for Minnesota in our schools. I appreciate being here at the table with my respected colleague, School Board Member Robert Erickson from Lakeville. I have a PowerPoint presentation. It's got about 12 slides, so I believe the committee has that presentation. If not, I want to share these comments as I've mentioned. As I stated, I served on that task force, and in addition to my task force service, I want to tell you a little bit about myself. Maybe bring a bit of a face to this. I'm a mother of an adult daughter. I've got two step-grandchildren, seven step-grandchildren, eight great-grandchildren, for a total of 18 souls. Their experiences are part of the lens I look through to the question of integration. I'm also beginning my third term and my 11th year as a member of the Robbinsdale School Board, and in Robbinsdale we serve over 11,000 students. I'm currently serving as the Robbinsdale representative to the West Metro Education Program, which is one of the three metro integration districts. Before I begin my PowerPoint, I want to share a couple of personal thoughts, and they kind of go to, I think we've heard earlier from Representative Mariani, Chair Mariani, the Board of Brown versus Board of Education. I had the great fortune to receive an integrated education. Close on the heels of the Brown versus Board of Education, starting in about 1956. Schooled in the northern Midwest suburban community, my experience, unlike many children in 1956 America, began and continued throughout my education in an integrated environment. Little did I know at that time and for many years following how different my experience was from many, many children who looked like me. My parents, both hailing from deep south Mississippi, migrated to the north shortly after my birth. The route they took was through Birmingham, Alabama. And had they stayed there, I could easily have been one of the three little black girls who died in a church bombed at the height of racial segregation in the south. As I have grown older and a little more knowledgeable, my awareness of that reality has nestled in my consciousness in a way that helps me remember the scourge of segregation in a special and a personal way. So I come to this discussion as one who has experienced integrated schooling as a matter of course. Indeed, I have only been in the last 25 years or so come to realize the ongoing discourse and tension around segregated schooling is far from over. And as Myron Orfield will tell us, the housing patterns in Minnesota have reconstituted patterns that have resulted in highly segregated living spaces in Minnesota. There are outcomes and realities that are shaped by those circumstances. We all come here today with the lived experience of moving through segregated and integrated environments on a daily basis, based upon our daily activities, our interests, our families, and our work lives. We experience these spaces de facto. The skill that one has moving through those spaces matters. As a resident of a first-ring suburb and a representative of a first-ring suburban school district, a district that partners with the collaborative effort of WEMAP and Integration District, our charge is to prepare our students to navigate a complex world, to prepare some of them to one day take one of your seats and to one day take mine. So the preparation of students to navigate a complex and changing world is part of our charge. I was proud to be appointed and to serve as a member of the Integration Task Force, a task force that came to an agreement and associated recommendations in a bipartisan fashion. My intention is to focus my testimony from my perspective as a Robbinsdale School Board member and the chair of WEMAP. I'd like to illustrate how integration is being used effectively to provide integrated, equitable learning environments that enhance professional development for our staff and increase student achievement. And so once again, before I start this PowerPoint, in case I forget, because I'm quite nervous, I just want to thank you for this opportunity to have a hearing. We appreciate it.
You're welcome, Ms. Bassett. Again, I'm going to ask that you try to focus in on the key elements of your testimony.
Be very focused.
Thank you very much.
And so, of course, just my heading, and again, speaking to culturally competent teaching, equitable effective practices, policies, and partnerships with integrated opportunities for learning is really the focus of my comments. So what did we do on that Integration Revenue Replacement Task Force? Our committee engaged in substantive dialogue. We considered alternative viewpoints, stretched our imagination, focused on common good for students and staff within the context of current constraints and competing demands, therefore, of course, our recommendation to hold the line on the costs. What I learned, when a conscious and deliberate equity focus is applied to teaching strategies, and I learned that from a number of professionals as well as my own experience, students of color and those dependent on free and reduced lunch can and do make academic gains. Support for integration and aid leverages investments in early childhood education. It's not an either-or choice, which is, in my opinion, a false choice. The fact of the matter is that integration revenue helps students across the grade continuum. If they get that early start with early childhood education and we support that, then they continue to need support as they go through their school life. Integration aid allows for targeted, specialized services to be delivered to those kids across their continuum of education. So who benefits from integration aid and why does it matter? Well, of course, we've changed. Others have told you, and I'm sure you've heard from various demographers about what Minnesota looks like, and just in the Star Tribune, we heard references to the number, for example, of Hispanic students rising from 48,000 to 60 to 59,000. Also, the immersion programs and the kind of the prominence of those programs from 40 to 85 now. Okay, so our students do matter, and of course, here's a picture of some of our students and some of our staff. Okay, integration dollars uniquely allow for targeted programming, flexibility for innovation across the grade levels, as I've mentioned, and enhances the scaffolding of programs that support alignment of teaching and learning from early childhood through 12th grade. It uniquely leverages general education aid, early childhood, and family connections. It's very important for us to talk about the general education aid that we get, and you probably know better than I the vast amount of money that goes into general education, but we're using that money wisely. And you'll see from Avid to other programs where we're using that, but the opportunity to target those funds with integration aid is irreplaceable. There is no other funding that allows us to do the kinds of things that we can do with this funds. The professional development does matter. From our superintendent, Aldo Sacoli at Robbinsdale, we have a two-year plan in place right now for all of our licensed staff to participate in equity training, focus on training for non-licensed staff to create better alignment that leads to student achievement for all. From our Peter Eckhoff, the president of Robbinsdale Federation of Teachers, because I asked them, I have my own thoughts about how I think it helps, but it's important to talk to the workforce. They say that integration revenue is used to provide access to programs that students may not otherwise participate in. A major cornerstone of their use of the integration is paying for the cultural liaisons. That's been talked about already. These individuals provide invaluable resources to our staff, students, and families, and importantly, they bridge between our staff and those families and leverage that. We've used our cultural liaisons, for example, the question was asked about how do we use the money. We just recently in Robbinsdale started a science and technology magnet school. Historically, you may know that magnet schools typically don't always attract students who are of high poverty need. And so one of the ways that we use our cultural liaisons is to work with us to do a targeted recruitment for families to make sure we had balance that more closely resembled the balance that we have in our district. And happily, we've hit closer to that mark than we've ever hit before in one of our magnet schools. Okay, we help integration aid helps ensure integration and equity are in practice district-wide. As public partners with the district, we help break down the possible barriers to communication between those families, and they work with us on a variety of other outreach activities. And this from our program director of equity and integration, Marcellus Davis. Okay. I knew that we probably would hear about AVID from Bob, and no surprise that we use some of our funds for AVID programs as well. In Robbinsdale Elementary and Middle School, achievement growth measures of academic progress continue to increase, again, from our superintendent. We just saw increase in our early education this year from some of those efforts that we have in place. Project Lead the Way, which is a technology and engineering program for middle school, and all of those programs provide alignment for our students from early first grade, actually, because we also have a primary years program for international baccalaureate. And, of course, our general education dollars are supporting that, but these dollars from integration help leverage that and provide the targeted help these students need. So one of the things we've done as a board is we've instituted an apartment outreach initiative. We had a listening session, importantly, the school board. The school board had a listening session with our cultural liaison so that we can learn better how we could be more effective in reaching out to our parents of a variety of backgrounds to get them more engaged in our schools, because we feel like that's important to their students' education. And we want to do that from a place where they feel comfortable talking with us. And so we went out in the snow and the cold, and we went to apartment buildings, our school board did, and along with our staff. And we have been listening to see how we can do that better. So that's just one of the examples. I don't want to leave this conversation without talking about the West Metro Education Program and the inter-district supports that we have there. You see a picture here of one of the two schools that WEMEP operates. That's the Fair School located in Crystal, Minnesota, and of course there's also the Fair School downtown. Together, both of those schools serve 1,000 students, and of course that's a collective shared effort. One of the things that this body in previous years and perhaps ongoing has talked about is shared resources and shared services. Coming together in these integration districts allows us to leverage those dollars and to do that work. Regionally, WEMEP serves over 100,000 staff and students. It models that shared services for professional development that I spoke of and provides groundbreaking services. I wanted to provide you with a graphic that talked about, we've talked a little bit about how the districts have changed over time, and in the metro, you'll see the 11 member districts that are a part of WEMEP and includes the Minneapolis Public Schools. And Minneapolis Public Schools, of course, is one of our chief partners and actually sends over half of the students that we have in our two schools hail from Minneapolis. And so we're very conscious of the challenges that Minneapolis has. We work together in a collaborative effort to try to make sure that we're addressing all of the needs of all of our districts. You see the range of free and reduced lunch at all of our schools, starting with Columbia Heights in descending order from 74%, 69%, 65%, and on down to Edina with 9%. And so a collaborative that reaches across a range like that is no small thing. And finally, I want to acknowledge the visionary leadership of those who crafted the early intra-district models from EMID, WEMEP, and the Northwest Suburban District. We're fortunate that in the audience today with me is the acting superintendent of WEMEP, Ms. Antoinette Johns, Dr. Johns. And Dr. Johns, would you stand? And finally, I want to thank Chair Mariani and the members again for welcoming us to share our thoughts on this matter. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bassett. I have to say that you covered a really wide range of territory very quickly. Nevertheless, we are against the timeline. There are a couple members on the list for questions. I'm only going to take the questions from those who have put them their name on earlier so we can get more testimony. And hopefully Tuesday we'll have more time for across-the-board discussion. But I'm concerned that we get our testifiers in as best as possible today. So Representative Barrett.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to thank Ms. Bassett for being here today, and I want to thank you for your work at the Robbinsdale School District. My wife, being a graduate of Cooper, I know what quality education Robbinsdale provides. So that was a couple years ago, but anyway, thank you. To Mr. Erickson, I wanted to talk about that audit for a moment and get your thoughts on what happened as a result of the audit. A lot of us who were new last year in the legislature looked at opportunities to use money more wisely, especially given the fact we had a $6.2 billion budget deficit, and it was necessary to look at those areas that really weren't performing up to snuff. A lot of us concentrated on that audit that I think, as you mentioned, or Representative Mariani mentioned, happened in 2005. Of course, then last year was the year before was 2011. That's quite the time frame between 2005 and 2011 before really anything or before a bill was drafted to try to improve the funding. You had mentioned that after 2005, or I think you did, or Representative Mariani might have, but regarding closing the achievement gap is something that people looked at right away after that audit came out in 2005. Can you just address that issue and tell me what achievement has happened as it relates to the achievement gap from 2005 on?
Mr. Erickson.
Madam Chair, Representative, in not specific detail, because I don't have that document in front of me, but having focused as a task force member on that issue specifically, there was about after 2005, there was a 1 to 2 year time frame where I think districts are starting to consider focusing on the achievement gap. And I would say that the program, from my vantage point, one of the programs that really proved, first of all, to be necessary and statistically successful is the Abbott program. And that started 5 years ago. So it didn't start immediately after the legislative auditor's report. There was a couple of years gap. I wasn't serving on a school board at that time, but reading the historical record and then listening to the testimony from 41 presenters over a four-month period, I learned that initially a lot of attention was brought to bear regarding the auditor's report, but it took a couple of years for districts to engage in pursuing that. And statistically, the most significant achievement that I can think of is the Abbott program that's been in place in 31 school districts for 5 years has demonstrated clearly the significant gap that's been addressed and the achievements that have been made. I did present a document today that the staff indicated that they would be forwarding to you before your next meeting that statistically addresses that and how many doors have been opened for protected students to become involved in AP classes. And the graduation rate for our first graduating class of Avid a year ago was 100% of those students were accepted in a 2 or 4 year institution of higher learning. 100% graduated, and these 100% students, which we've tracked now into their first college year, which came back and spoke to our Avid students this year, and is in the information that you'll be provided before your next hearing, clearly demonstrates that those are the kinds of programs that are being funded and are addressing and effectively closing the achievement gap.
Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Quick question. I know we have a lot of folks and a lot of people to talk, but my question, let me restate my question. Looking at it globally, looking at Minnesota globally from 2005 through 2013, what has happened with our achievement gap in the state, given the funds we've used to try to eliminate the gap in Minnesota? Has it improved? Has it stayed the same? Has it gone down?
Well, we appreciate your question. And Madam? May I speak?
May I speak? I'm sorry, yes, Ms. Beth. Okay, I had another representative
who wants to speak to this point also. We want to follow the rules.
Yes.
I just quickly want to just say this. You know, you ask about the achievement cap, and you ask about, kind of related to the legislative auditor's report. And the fact of the matter is that since that time, education policy has not stood still. Over the last, probably, let me just say, 6 years or so, and probably even a little bit longer, the way even we measure how students are doing has changed several times, at least three. We've had the profiles of learning. We've had, I can't even name them all. We've had several. The fact of the matter is that our general education dollars then, which are primarily charged with the achievement gap, you know, have been trying to deal with that. But they have to retool each time to configure to the test for people to take the test. We only had the legislation change for the integration revenue in 2009 that really specifically called out academic achievement. And of course, that came at a time when we had not previously had parameters around what are the best practices that we think we want to use, and some kind of an evaluation measure that went across all of them. I think we were very fortunate, quite frankly, to get that auditor's report that really talked about some of the egregious deficits of what some of the practice was. We've now been able to look at that. And I think districts are trying to work toward, meeting some of those questions. And I think we're doing a pretty good job. In Robbinsdale, what I can tell you is that the early childhood achievement, and also for WEMAP, we just looked at information last night and had a slide that talked about in our early grades how we've closed the reading gap with some of those children. And the growth measures that we're seeing in Robbinsdale are remarkable in terms of what's happening with our early education for children. And so we've made gains there. I think it's a mistake to look to the integration revenue to be the sole and the only tool that we have to ameliorate that gap, because we all know that so many things come to the question already. And so to expect one targeted intervention to take care of all of that is a mistake. However, when you take that money and leverage it along with the billions that we get for general education funding, then we have an opportunity to really do some things. Our other funds are categorical and really have a lot of parameters around how they can be used. So in order to be consistent with the laws that we're required to meet up with, we have to make sure we're doing that. And so then the flexibility that we have with innovation with those integration dollars allows us to get in there and target special kinds of programs, work with some of those parents in ways that we probably couldn't in other ways. So.
Representative Dabney, briefly to this point.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Barrett, you ask a good question, and I can't answer statewide over that 2005 to 2013 period, but I can tell you in Minneapolis in the last 3 years that with our High Five program, our four-year-old kindergarten program, that is disproportionately children in high poverty and disproportionately English language learners, over the last 3 years, readiness for kindergarten is up 3 points with that population. 78% of those children are assessed as ready for kindergarten. Looking at achievement gap reduction in Minneapolis over the last 3 years on math and reading, African-American and Native American students have posted the largest gains, with African-American students up 8 points over those 3 years, Hispanic students up 4 points, Asian students up 4 points, and American Indian students up 5 points. Interestingly, Somali-speaking students are showing the largest gains in Minneapolis.
Representative Dabney, I'm sorry, but okay. I really feel a compelling need to interrupt you, mostly because we have seven other groups of testifiers.
Well, Representative Barrett had asked about closing the achievement gap,
yes.
And I had actual data for him
Maybe the two of you could actually talk after. That would be great.
Thank you.
Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We do have a number of other districts here that can also share perhaps similar information, although I want to say, Representative Barrett, your broader point is well taken. You know, the answer, quite frankly, is that we have barely moved at best statewide in the aggregate across the state on this critical issue of the achievement gap. We can't pretend that that's not happening. However, what is happening is that there are emerging powerful results that are coming forward partly fueled by this one tool among other tools. I think that's what Ms. Bassett said. And I think that's what we have to sort of hang, you know, our hope, and then build a dominant approach as opposed to just accepting, you know, great success in one school district in this corner of the state. That's just not going to cut it for us. So I really appreciate the question. But Madam Chair, there are others that are going to share some insights on that particular point.
So I am going to, Representative Anderson has been waiting quite a while to ask a question, and you may go ahead and ask either of our testifiers, but in the meantime, I'm going to ask to come down Keith Lester, William Gronseth, Sarah Gleason, and Phyllis Hill to be prepared to testify. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you both for testifying. Mr. Erickson, earlier in your presentation, you mentioned something about accountability and staffing and being a businessman. When I hear those two things, my radar really lights up. And I was wondering, is there some sort of a model or a study to justify that if there was an increasing in staffing, that would improve accountability? And would that really ensure a greater accountability?
The task force certainly, Madam Chair.
Mr. Erickson.
Representative Anderson. The task force, from the testimony it received in its independent research, concluded that the $100 million of revenue shared by 131 districts lacked the oversight from a budgeting standpoint that we believe is necessary. And that's why we recommended 0.2% or $200,000 out of the $100 million appropriation to enhance, strengthen that process by MDE, being able to having the personnel to review those budgets, having consistency, and then ultimately accountability. Driven by our emphasis on 80% of the money being spent in the classroom, someone has to monitor and make sure that the plans that we have in place do that effectively, and that we do not spend more than 10% on administration. We do not want high-paid coordinators operating within the context of this program, capturing the disproportionate amount of money, taking it away from where it's needed to close the achievement gap, which is the classroom.
Thank you for that answer.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Erickson. Ms. Bassett.
Thank you.
Keith Lester, Superintendent of Brooklyn Center Schools, you're on the docket, and I hope you can take 3 minutes to focus your comments. Sorry. We have seven groups of testifiers. And then would William Gronseth please come up and join, have a chair at the table, and then Isaiah has Sarah Gleason and Phyllis Hill. If you could all be there ready to take your turn at testifying, so maybe we could aim with this group to be done about 11:15 or 11:17. We just want to finish the people who've come, you know, to testify today, because we will have more testifiers next week. Thank you very much, and introduce yourself for the record, please.
My name is Keith Lester. I'm Superintendent of Schools in Brooklyn Center and also the proud chair of the Minnesota Minority Education Partnership Board. I have to put that in because I have a board meeting in an hour, so thank you for getting me in. So, I'm going to try to focus on the key elements. I have 50 of them, and that was a joke. I don't have 50 elements.
Good.
Let me tell you where I come from. I come from Brooklyn Center, Minnesota, and I literally do. I graduated from the high school there. I went away. I worked somewhere else. And then I came back. And when I came back, I saw a whole new world. In fact, I talked to the first graduating class. I said, the amazing thing about being in Brooklyn Center is it is like being in the world, what the world really looks like. And that was huge for me. That doesn't minimize where I was, and especially I want to say that because Representative Erickson is here and Representative, I just forgot your name. Yeah, Faust. I'm sorry. That was good. Diversity there was Swedes and Norwegians. In Brooklyn Center, it's a whole lot different than that. You saw 69% poverty up on the screen. We have an online program that we work with. we never see those kids. They're all over the state. They affect the demographics. If you walk into our buildings, you're looking at 80% poverty. You're looking at 80% diversity. You're looking at over 20% special education. You're looking at 25-plus in ELL students. It's a different world. And how you focus, how you spend your money is really very important. And when I look at it, and I know this isn't a money, this is a policy, but I have to frame it a little bit with that. You know, in Minneapolis, and I don't want any of their money, and I want to say that clearly, Jim, that I don't want any of their money, but they get $445 per student, St. Paul also. We get $129. We have the same demographics, as do Columbia Heights and Richfield. Those three look like Minneapolis and St. Paul. Now, times have changed since the money was first allocated, but the bottom line is that we look like them. If, for example, we're in statutory operating debt. If you haven't heard, we were for at one time the poster child for defeated levy referendum because we had a poverty poor district, we had no money, we were in financial trouble, and we struggled. And not that we could have used that money for that purpose, but had we been able to get the same amount of money per pupil since 2005, we would have had $4,400,000 more money. We're $2 million in statutory operating debt. I would be one of those high-paid administrators that you were just talking about if we'd had that kind of money. But more important, we would have put more money into education. Now, Brooklyn Center is a community school district. We believe that you educate the whole child, you work with your community, you work with partners, you work with agencies, you work with the government, and you do what you can to educate every child, and you give them an equal opportunity to succeed. What this is to me is a social justice issue.
That's right.
It's about the education of children, where they are, and what they deserve. You can move kids all you want, but if they move to a place that isn't of the quality that they need, you haven't accomplished anything. They can come to you, and if you can't offer them what they need, it doesn't accomplish anything. So I think it's important to say that. When you're talking about achievement gap, you have this thing, and I'll give you, how am I doing? Am I close?
You're just about over time.
I'm to my last one.
But 30 seconds.
Oh, holy cow. Wow, how do I do this? The fact of the matter is, if you have less money and you can't focus the money where you need it, then you lose kids because they go someplace where they can find it because we have choice. And then you have less money again, and you also get in trouble academically, and you have this vicious circle of losing money, getting poor scores, losing money, and you're not focusing on the kids. We believe that kids come to school with barriers every day, whether it's mental health or dental or whatever it is. Kids can't succeed if they are fighting other barriers. Let's not let them fight the barrier of race. Let's not make them fight the barrier of poverty or any of these others that are related to what this bill has to say. I think it's critical if we're going to be successful for our children, and it's different in every district. Please remember that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Superintendent Lester. Sorry to rush you. Stay put. There may be a few questions for you, and then William Granseth, Superintendent of Duluth Public Schools.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for inviting me here today to talk to you about integration funding, and I second everything that Superintendent Lester said. And thank you to Chair Mariani for introducing the bill to restore integration revenue, including the integration levy. As you know, students of color are struggling across the state, and Duluth is no exception. It's not easy for me to tell you that today African American students have a graduation rate of only about 50% in Duluth. And even more alarming, 1 in 4 American Indian students graduates in 4 years. Poverty is also an issue in Duluth. Nearly 50% of Duluth students qualify for free and reduced price lunch. The lack of availability of affordable housing has created concentrated areas of both high poverty and minority populations in Duluth, and this creates unique challenges for the Duluth schools. We have attempted to recreate boundaries to address these issues, but affordable housing is so highly concentrated that this was not feasible. This results in stark differences between schools in Duluth. While the minority population of one school may be as low as 1 or 2% other schools' populations are made up of over 60% students of color. These same schools have free and reduced price lunch levels of over 75%, while others have below 10%. The additional monies made available through the integration funds helps us to serve those most vulnerable students. As you are aware, there's a wide achievement gap that exists between students of color and white students, students living in poverty and those who are more affluent, and students who receive special education and those who don't. But especially for students who fall into more than one of those categories, specific interventions are needed to help them realize success in learning, to graduate from high school, to achieve their personal goals. And the Duluth schools have listened to Commissioner Casilius and Governor Dayton and have taken bold steps with these funds in an attempt to reduce the achievement gap. A perfect example is our integration specialists. These employees, most of whom are people of color themselves, work both within schools and throughout the community. They reach out to families as liaisons to the school. They have facilitated parent training sessions to help parents understand how to best help their kids in school. They intervene when absenteeism becomes an issue, arrange for tutors when grades become an issue, help to build strong relationships between parents and educators, and help to increase the cultural competence of our teachers. And they also encourage students to envision a better future for themselves, and we've begun to see improvements in attendance and in student achievement. Parents of color are becoming more active in our schools, and although we are partnering with several nonprofit organizations and with the City of Duluth to address these issues, given the extremely tight financial state of education, none of this would be possible without this funding. We would lose both the growth we have begun to realize and, more importantly, the relationships in the community that have begun to heal. The community as a whole and communities of color have been extremely involved with Duluth integration programs since the 1980s and would feel betrayed by the state if the integration was no longer considered a priority. I'm not suggesting that other communities are without similar challenges, but I don't believe that taking the integration funds away from districts that desperately need it is the answer either. Instead, I ask you to take bold actions, as the governor has asked, for students of color across our state and to restore integration funding as Chair Mariani has proposed, not only for my district, but to assist other districts as well. Madam Chair and committee members, thank you again for this opportunity, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Superintendent. I'd like to take the testimony from the Isaiah people, and then we'll take a couple questions people have asked. So either Sarah Gleason or Phyllis Hill, and introduce yourself for the record, please.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Sarah Gleason. I'm a member of St. Joan of Arc Catholic Church, which is one of about 90 congregations that make up Isaiah. And we come together in Isaiah as people of faith to advance our vision for equity and shared prosperity across the state of Minnesota. We, over the last 4 years, have met with dozens of administrators, school board members, superintendents from districts across the metro area and St. Cloud, talking with them about their use of integration revenue and how it relates to overall to their racial equity work. And we closely follow the task force. We were there for every meeting. We met with many of the members individually. As people of faith, we're commanded to love one another. We're guided by the deep knowledge that our lives and our faiths are inextricably entwined. We believe that if we choose to put thriving children, families, and communities at the center of all our public decision making, we can prosper together. Isaiah is committed to racial, economic, and geographic equity, which we define as the proactive reinforcement of policies, practices, attitudes, and actions that produce equitable power, opportunities, treatment, impacts, and outcomes for all Minnesotans. We believe all public investments and all public policy must increase equity in order to advance our collective health and prosperity. I told you that we closely followed the task force. The reason that we did that is because we believe that the path to a healthy and prosperous future for Minnesota is rooted in opening access to opportunity, restorative investment, and communities growing together. Despite significant differences among the members, as you've heard, in approach and orientation, even understanding of the purpose and charge of the task force, After many hours of learning together and serious dialogue, they were able to come together in agreement in support of this set of recommendations. We have called on the legislature and continue to call upon you to follow their lead in coming together across lines of division to create this program. As people of faith, we know that our individual health and wholeness depends on the health and wholeness of our community. The health and prosperity of our entire state depends on our ability to learn, work, and grow together across race, class, and geography. The proposed AIM program would build our ability to do this while addressing some of the equity gaps that have excluded and held back students and families of color and resulted in our well-known racial achievement gap. We see school integration as one crucial strategy in achieving equity in education. Truly integrated schools affirm the identities and cultures of all students and provide equitable access to opportunities and to power. They break down stereotypes and barriers to full participation. They build relationships across difference, and they teach skills for working together and sharing power. They provide students and families of color with access to opportunity, power, and resources, and white students and families with access to wholeness and the opportunity to exercise faith and hope. Integrated schools are critical in breaking the cycle of systemic racism and are essential for the health of our democracy and a necessary tool for achieving equity, the foundation of our shared prosperity. We believe that our current approach to school choice has allowed us to ignore our responsibility to ensure that all students in all schools have real access to opportunity. It's had the impact of pitting school districts against one another, segregating schools, and leaving behind disadvantaged students and families. It has not been an equitable system. We support efforts to decrease barriers to choice and increase access to opportunity for families of color and low-income families. Our state owes all students and families a quality education with opportunities to explore a range of interests, have access to powerful networks and relationships, excellent teachers, and the resources needed to support student development. Our efforts toward integration must be equitable in both process and outcomes. This requires an intentional focus on equity and transparency and accountability to families and communities. The AIM program would create this.
Ms. Hill, could I just ask you to wrap it up?
One last sentence.
Thank you.
It would also promote collaboration and shared learning among school districts across our state, which we believe our whole state benefits from.
And I want to apologize. I know these are really deeply felt and critical issues, and I think we were overly ambitious in the amount of testimony we thought we could effectively take today. And so I apologize to everyone. We still have several testifiers who haven't come to the podium. Ms. Gleason, are you Sarah Gleason? Or okay. No, I'm sorry. You are Phyllis Hill.
That would be correct.
Would you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Phyllis Hill. I'm the lead organizer for ISAIAH. We are excited to testify, and as people of faith, as Sarah just explained, we're here to share our values and why integration is important. And as other people have reiterated over and over again, integration is one tool, just one tool, to create equity. And although this is our testimony as ISAIAH, we stand in partnership and solidarity with many other organizations who support our work, such as Parents United, Education Minnesota, African American Leadership Forum, SEIU Local 284, and many others. We are very excited about the recommendations made last February, so much in fact that we are partnering with Human Impact Partners and a wide range of other community members to look at the health impact of the recommendations and what they how they would impact the child all over our state from a health standpoint. So we have already started that process, and we will more than likely update you on what we find out. I am here to talk about the essential elements of the recommendations that ISAIAH supports. We see public education as the cornerstone of democracy, and where we prepare our children to be engaged and contributing members of their communities, not just good test takers. We see the vision reflected in the use of the integration revenue to prepare all students to be effective citizens, enhance social cohesion, and reinforce democratic values. We believe that to achieve this vision, our schools, policies, practices, and people must be aligned and accountable, not only to the standardized test scores, but also to the progress on measures of equity and opportunity, such as access to early education, advanced level programs and post-secondary preparation, elimination of tracking based on race and class, equalization of disciplinary treatment, and increasing staff diversity and cultural competence. We know that our children's success in school can only be achieved in partnership with their families. This understanding is reflected in the use of AIM revenues to promote and support family engagement. This must include effective approaches to build parent power, and we think that is very important to have parent power in order for us to create healthy communities and healthy schools. Because we believe the transparency and accountability to the community is an important aspect to the path of racial and economic equity, we support local establishment of goals and accountability and reporting of local communities. We recognize that local control has often operated in favor of the most privileged. We must ensure that throughout the process, the interests of all parts of our communities, particularly those that are the most vulnerable, are included. We strongly support the use of AIM revenue for professional development. We need teachers and other supporting adults that are ready, willing, and able to validate, affirm, and care and nurture all children, particularly those of color. That has been a systematic racial justice issue for not only the nation but our state. The AIM requirements that district implement formative assessment practices is also crucial. Educators need timely, useful assessments to inform, shape, target their interventions and practice, and students need them to recognize and support their development success. In short, because I know I'm running short on time here, this is a regional problem that demands regional solutions. That's one reason why we stand in support of this. We, ASEA also supports the examination of the merits of one collaborative metropolitan integration district. In closing, I will say that integration and the pursuit of equity is not a social experiment, but a moral and social imperative. As people of faith, we deeply believe that healthy, equitable communities are possible. We can create the communities that we want and that we need. We just have to have the will to do so.
Thank you very much for your passionate and informed testimony. I'm going to ask members to indulge me. We have three other testifiers who have come and cannot return on Tuesday. If you're willing to stay a few minutes past 11:30, we can have some discussion with the testifiers we've had, and then we'll continue discussion next Tuesday. So at this point, if Dorothy Bialke and Kate McGuire and James Burrows could come forward to testify. And I'll let you choose who would like to go first. Introduce yourself for the record. And if you can just take a few minutes so we can allow some discussion time from members, that would be helpful.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll begin. My name is Dorothy Bialke, and I'm the Executive Director of Northwest Suburban Integration School District. We are a collaborative of eight school districts from the Northwest Metro, including Moundsview, Fridley, Brooklyn Center, Osseo, Rockford, Elk River, Buffalo Hanover, Montrose, and the Anoka Hennepin School District. Our students are 95,000 strong, and they live across five school districts. Our work at Northwest Suburban is very much in alignment with what the task force has recommended, and I have a handout that's being brought to you that outlines how we work and how that supports what has been recommended by the task force. In the area of integrated and innovative learning environments, we work in collaboration with our school districts of running 22 magnet schools that have three themes. Those schools are run by their home school district, and over 12,000 students attend those schools or programs within a school. We coordinate just over 4,000 students to attend those programs through school choice, where parents are applying for their children to attend outside of their neighborhood schools. And these schools are very effective. They're creating students or developing students who use the 21st century skills of creativity, collaboration, critical thinking, and communication. They are being academically prepared and culturally competent. We have two schools just that I can name off the top of my head that started as a magnet school when they were racially isolated, and they no longer are racially isolated. So part of the goals is being achieved in those buildings. We work with in the area of family engagement. We help school districts empowers parents of students of color to take leadership roles within the schools. We provide them training, and then we also help them go back into their local neighborhood communities and church communities and help empower other parents of students of color to be engaged more readily in their children's education and in the school districts. We work in collaboration with early childhood education and Head Start in helping parents of four-year-olds understand school choice, kindergarten readiness, and how to maneuver the K-12 education system, often a system that these are parents who are immigrants themselves that are unknowledgeable because they did not grow up in the United States. We work with professional development for our school districts in a lot of different areas, including creating culturally competent teachers and how to work with students from various ethnic, cultural, and economic backgrounds. We work in the classrooms around various topics that help students see positive role models of color, of adults in color in their classroom. This is especially important for some of our school districts that are less diverse, because this allows those school children to see adults of the same race as they are in a positive role in their school community. And we really work with Access for Opportunity. We support AVID programs. We have a summer summit for boys that helps boys who are finishing the eighth grade, who are lacking kind of a goal of how to get through high school, to come together and work together and set goals for high school, and they have long-term mentoring for them. And we have a student leadership conference. We have future educator clubs where we're encouraging all students, but especially students of color, to explore educational careers. The last page of my handout kind of gives you some information. I continually want to hear all of you asking, are the dollars that we are spending, is there a positive impact? So on the last page, I'd like to show you some of the positive impacts of closing this achievement gap for some of our schools. And this is just a highlight. This is certainly not all the data that I can provide you. But for instance, if we look at Weaver Lake Elementary School, it's a science, math, and technology school. It's in the Osseo School District. When it became a magnet school, it was racially isolated, and it is no longer racially isolated. In the last 5 years, all students have increased their proficiencies by 18% in reading, 10% in math, and 27% in science. Another example is Blaine High School's Center for Engineering, Mathematics, and Science. It is a program within the larger high school. Last year, 100% of their students were proficient in reading, 80% in math, and 82% in science, which far exceeds any of the state averages. There is no longer a gap between white students and minority students in reading and science. What's also remarkable about that school is they've had 2 years of graduates for 104 students. 63 of them are enrolled in engineering programs. 15 of them are enrolled in similar programs. And collectively, they have received over $1 million of scholarships. Yeah. So it's showing they really are becoming academically prepared. One more highlight, and then I'm done. Coon Rapids Middle School has an AVID program. We've heard about it here. We can just show you that AVID students in reading scored 86.2% were proficient, with the district average of being only 69. So I just want to show that we do have the data to support the positive. And thank you so much for allowing me to
speak. Thank you, Ms. Bielke. And Mr. Burrows.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Mariani. My name is James Burrows. I'm the Executive Director for Equity and Diversity and also Family and Community Engagement for the Minneapolis Public Schools. On behalf of Dr. Bernadette Johnson and our school board, we emphatically support HF 247, and for three main reasons. One is we believe it's a compelling state interest in order to have, you should have, integrated learning environments. And the reason is not because students can't learn in segregated environments. Let me clear something up real fast for me. I was born and raised in Detroit, Michigan, and at the time in the 70s and 80s, it was very racially isolated. Most of my schools were African-American schools. And my high school, about 3,000 students, most were African-American, 85% of us went on to four-year colleges and universities. Most of us now are doctors, lawyers. I'm a lawyer myself, dentists, and other things. So it can be done. There are also schools that are predominantly white schools throughout this country that do well academically. But wouldn't you want an environment for your children where you could have a diverse environment, an integrated environment, and all students are doing well? That's what we're here to support the integration bill, because it's not saying that you can't do it in racially isolated schools, but you have a much richer multicultural environment where students are learning from each other in an integrated learning environment. Also with that, we use our resources to also support student development and also staff development around cultural competency. One of the partnerships we've been able to do with the integration dollars is called the Institute for Teachers Development on Cultural Development and Focused Instruction, which gives our teachers an understanding of how to address the needs of our 70% students of color, our over 90 languages spoken in the Minneapolis school districts as well. So that's an important component of what we do. We also support this recommendation, this bill, because it was a bipartisan recommendation that I also thought was going to get a 6-6 vote rather than a 10-2 vote. I was surprisingly shocked that after long testimony, after a lot of data and research, I got a chance to testify before that committee, that they came out with a 10-2 recommendation that supports not only keeping the dollars where they are, but not asking for more money. Not asking for more money to do less, but saying what we have now we can use in different ways. It's rare that Minneapolis Public Schools, not rare, but Jim always tells me, Grothwell, that he goes over to the legislature to sometimes get the money for us. In this case, we're going to lose about $3 million estimated if this bill passes. That's the key thing for me, because I would rather have integration continue rather than just be about Minneapolis, St. Paul, or Duluth, just those school districts of the first class. If we have to lose some revenue in order for integration to continue throughout the state, that's an important part and component for us as well. The last piece of this is, with the growing diversity we have in the state, my background is in diversity work for the last 20 years in public and private companies. In order for us to prepare a workforce that's going to be relevant for Minnesota and the world, it has to be an integrated school system that prepares that workforce. Students learn from each other so much these days, and things that they don't just learn in the classroom, but from relationships and building those relationships throughout. I do want to take 2 seconds of my time to answer a couple of questions I heard. One was about the if you put more money into the state office and invest more in the one person that's there now, Dr. Ann Parks, would that get you better evaluation? I think it will, because when I first inherited this at Minneapolis Public Schools, there were about 4 people in that office, and they were able to not only evaluate the budgets that went in, they came and did site visits, helped us tighten up our programs, better align them with student needs and achievement. With only one person there, I love Dr. Parks to death, but it's hard for her to get out to 131 school districts in order to do that. We've been able to, in Minneapolis, to retain some of those former employees to help us design our integration strategy. So some of those employees who used to work in the state office are now helping us design and align our programs too. So that's very important there as well. As far as closing the achievement gap, Minnesota unfortunately ranks at the bottom for students of color, especially black and brown boys and native boys in the country. I want to change that. Integration in and of itself can't change it by itself. It's just one strategy to getting towards equity. There are lots of other things that have to happen globally in the classroom and education financing in order to make that happen. But we will assure you this, if this bill passes, which I hope it does, we'll make sure that we continue to be aligned towards our goals. There are measurable metrics to identify if we're being successful or not. And we're willing to look at programs, too, that maybe haven't worked as well over the years and evaluate those and remove those as well. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Bruce. Now, Ms. McGuire, you are at the disadvantage of being 3 minutes past our normal adjournment time. Would you like to have our remaining 3 or 4 minutes regardless? It's up to you. You have come to testify, and I would like to give you that opportunity. If members leave, don't take it personally. That's all. I'll stay here, and some others will stay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Would you identify yourself for the record, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kate McGuire, and I'm privileged to serve as the superintendent for Osseo Area Schools. Thank you for providing me with the opportunity to speak today. I come with additional data. I'm here to advocate for the Achievement and Integration Minnesota program. I'll share evidence of results we're getting in student achievement, and I'll urge you to support this bill as a mechanism to leverage resources to focus on equitable student achievement gains. Osseo Area Schools is the 5th largest school district in Minnesota. We serve more than 20,000 students in the northwest metropolitan suburbs of Brooklyn Park, Maple Grove, Dayton, Corcoran, Plymouth, Osseo, and Brooklyn Center, and a little bit of Rogers. Here's what sets us apart from other suburban school districts. Half of our 20,000 students are students of color. We serve the 3rd highest number of students of color in the state of Minnesota. We serve the 2nd highest number of Asian Pacific Islander students in the state. We have many racially identifiable schools, and we're a racially isolated school district. Your work this session is important to the practitioners in Osseo area schools. Let me explain. The key to closing the race-based achievement gaps is to ensure equitable student achievement, and that means that we ensure high levels of achievement for all of our students, accelerate achievement for students of color and other underperforming subgroups, and close the racial achievement gap. I want you to know that Osseo Area Schools is getting results that is leading to equitable student gains, that we know what it takes to get those results, and that we currently receive approximately $3 million in integration revenue, which we've used to develop integrated learning environments in six thriving magnet programs, which are part of the Northwest Suburban Integration School District. We also have used integration revenue to increase the number of staff of color, to increase the cultural responsiveness of our staff, to provide opportunities for interracial contact, and to increase student achievement. Let me give you five examples of the results that we're getting in our magnet schools that are leading to equitable gains in student achievement and having a slight impact on racial integration. On your handout for our school district, you'll see the following examples. On page one, you'll see an example of increasing graduation rates at Park Center High School, an international baccalaureate school, which very much looks exactly like schools in Minneapolis. The graduation rates for white, black, and Asian students is increasing, and the rates are above the state average for each group. All students are doing better, and students of color are making accelerated growth to catch up to their peers. That's what we mean by equitable gains. On the second page, you'll see examples from two separate magnet schools. At Birch Grove School for the Arts, you'll note that reading proficiency for white students has improved 14%, and over the same period of time has improved up to 27% for students of color. It's these kinds of accelerated gains that are necessary in order to close the racial achievement gap. The next data point on that same page shows evidence of success in reading at Weaver Lake STEM Magnet. You'll see that reading proficiency for white students has improved 7%, while at the same time we've accomplished accelerated gains of up to 31% for students of color. Again, accelerated gains for underperforming subgroups is the critical component. On page three, you'll see evidence of equitable gains at a junior high school in our district, a magnet program. Note that at Northview Junior High School, 7th and 8th grade math climbed above the state average and percent on track for proficiency on the MCA math. Our 8th grade math growth at Northview Junior High School, I believe, was the fourth highest in the state. On the last page, I've tried to graphically depict that our success accomplishing actual racial integration is mixed. Our greatest success story in this regard is Weaver Lake Science, Math, and Technology School, which began as a racially isolated school. And you can see that it's balanced now, slightly below the district's average. While the rate of racial isolation at Birch Grove Arts School has slowed, our other sites continue to have increases in the number of students of color served. We know what it takes to get these kinds of equitable student achievement gains, a shared vision that has equity at its very core, early learning, effective instructional practices, including standards-based instruction, assessment, and grading, culturally responsive curriculum and instruction, the examination of data with teams of teachers, intervention in both behavior and academics when students aren't meeting our highest expectations in both of those areas, so that we can decrease the racial predictability in our suspension rates and increase academic achievement. Most importantly, it takes teachers in classrooms with class sizes conducive to building the kinds of relationships that motivate students to learn. Last November, our operating levy failed by 120 votes out of 68,000 votes cast. And as a result, we're planning for more than $11 million in budget reductions over the next 2 years. And that number will climb to over $14 million if we don't receive the same amount of integration revenue that we currently receive. Reductions will impact the very things that I've just noted are critical to getting the kind of equitable results that we're getting in student achievement. Osseo Area Schools, then, with the third highest number of students of color in the state of Minnesota, will be reducing the very support that I've noted
the very practices that are helping us toward equitable achievement gains, the kind we're trying to accomplish across the state. We need your help. I'd ask that you support the Achievement and Integration for Minnesota program. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. I'm happy to answer questions.
And thank you. I see it's Dr. McGuire, and I apologize. I didn't know that first. I don't believe we'll have time for questions today, but if anyone is able to return Tuesday, we'll definitely allow a time for more member discussion with any additional testimony that might come from the public, pro or con. Representative Mari, what are your wishes with this bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I too want to thank the testifiers. We truly are blessed to have powerful educators who have a new and different vision for Minnesota, and hopefully we can continue to provide them the tools and the resources they need to do that. At this point, Madam Chair, we're going to continue this discussion on Tuesday. I would certainly invite all the testifiers to come back if possible for that, and my intention is that we would act on amendments and then vote on the bill at that time. And so, Madam Chair, I would move to lay House File 247. I have the right number?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
247 on the table.
So Representative Mariani has moved to lay the bill on the table.
Does Madam Chair?
Yes.
This is not in regard to the motion, but Chair Mariani, will there be time for additional amendments on Tuesday if members desire to offer them?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, that would be appropriate given the 24-hour rule that we have. Sure, yes.
So what I want to say in advance is any testimony we take will have to be in the context of allowing appropriate discussion of the amendments and time to do. Since today we did focus on the testimony, mm-hmm. and I know there is so much rich testimony, but the process will require us to curtail testimony on Tuesday to very limited. Yes, Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, Chair Dornis, who's chaired many committees, advises me wisely that the motion is just simply to lay over the bill.
Okay. So, yes, not to lay on. You are correct. Yes, the bill is laid over until Tuesday, not laid on the table. Thank you very much, Representative Dornis. So the meeting stands adjourned.